We're looking at Daniel. Hello. That's sort of weird. We were looking in Daniel chapter 2, and we looked at the setting in Daniel chapter 2, and we saw it was the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had had a dream, and he had summoned all the wise men into his presence, and he made an offer to the Chaldeans that anyone who could tell him what the dream was and explain its interpretation would be given gifts. But if they could not, they were to receive the death penalty. And the Chaldeans basically admitted in and of themselves they had no ability whatsoever to be able to explain to the king what the dream was or its interpretation. So the king got even more furious, saying they were biding for time, and he sent out Arioch, the king's executioner, to execute the judgment on these so-called wise men. But Daniel, in a very wise fashion, as it says in verse 14, discretion and discernment, asked for some time. He had a humble attitude, and his desire was to have time that he might be able to ask God for the interpretation of the dream. And then he prayed to God, he and his friends. They made the request made known to God, and then God gave them the revelation of the dream, or at least to Daniel, the revelation of the dream and its interpretation. And then they thanked God and blessed him for his wisdom and his power, and then they shared it with others. We finish looking at the way God brings about this revelation. Arioch wanted to be noticed because he found Daniel who knew how to interpret the dream, and certainly God did use Arioch to bring Daniel before King Nebuchadnezzar. We looked at Daniel, and he certainly was instrumental, being used of the Lord to understand the dream and its interpretation. We looked at the wise men. Of course, they were self-professed idiots. They said, we can't do this. We see God as being the ultimate revealer of the dream, but we also see Nebuchadnezzar had a part because he's the one who initially had the dream. Now, after last Sunday's time and looking at Daniel, my son came up to me, and he explained something that he thought was very interesting about Daniel chapter 2, verse 11. And he said, moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, and there is no one else who could declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. Well, they not only have a problem in the fact that they self-admit that they can't do what Nebuchadnezzar has asked, but they have a totally wrong understanding of who God is. Because God is a God who dwells with mortal flesh. And they said God is so austere, so distant, that he doesn't dwell with mortal flesh. And only the gods can know this dream and this interpretation. And since the gods never dwell with mortal flesh, there's no way we can know it. Well, the reality is God is opposed to the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. The reason why the wise men didn't know of a God who dwelt with mortal flesh is because their hearts were filled with pride. They thought they could do it all, even though they admit they can't. On the other hand, here is a humble man, Daniel, that God does dwell with, and God does reveal mysteries to. And I thought that was interesting, so I asked my son, I said, well, why didn't you share that in the sharing time? He said, well, I just want to tell you. Well, if something like that pops in your mind, share it with all of us. There are many things, trying to go over this in a cursory fashion, in a summary way, that a lot of things will be missed. If something hits you or strikes you between the eyes, let's share it with one another. Let's encourage one another and be iron sharpening iron in that way. All right, we're in verse 31 now, and we're looking at the interpretation of the dream. And Daniel says, you, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue The statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. It's interesting that Daniel says that it was a single great statue. This has the idea that the statue, as we're well aware, is going to be speaking of the time of the Gentiles and the rule of the Gentiles over what is known as the land of Palestine, where the Jews are living, is a single great statue, indicating that there is, in a sense, one unified history that's going to be spoken of here, even though it's going to be in parts. It says it was large and of extraordinary splendor. Of course, if it's made of gold, silver, bronze, and iron, that's going to be giving off a lot of light. Nebuchadnezzar is standing before this statue, and it's just glowing. It's of extraordinary splendor. And its appearance was awesome. This word awesome is a word that we get to fear from. This statue was fearful. That's why in Daniel chapter 2, verse 1, it says, "Now in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams and his spirit was troubled." He saw a statue in his dreams that made him fear. It was of extraordinary splendor and was awesome. One statue, though. Single statue. Verse 32. "The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You continued looking until a stone was cut without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." Now, in this interpretation, as he's going to explain in a minute, this head of gold represents Nebuchadnezzar or Babylon. The arms and chest of silver represents Medo-Persia, which would come up after Babylon. The belly and thighs of bronze represents Greece or Alexander the Great. And the iron represents Rome. When it says in verse 34, "a stone was cut without hands," we now see something that's totally different than the statue. The statue represents a unified picture of human history, particularly the rule of the Gentiles over the Jews. But now something totally different, without hands, is cut out of a mountain and crushes the statue. Something supernatural takes place at the end. It's not a work of man because it's a stone that's cut without hands. Now, what's interesting is to think about these metals. The most precious metal is at the top, gold. And the preciousness of the metals deteriorates on the way down, indicating that there was some sort of glory at the beginning. Toward the end, it just deteriorates to iron. On the other hand, or along with that, gold is the heaviest of those elements. Silver is the next heaviest, bronze the next heaviest, and iron is the lightest of all those elements. So the statue is top heavy. It also has feet of clay, toes of clay and iron. So it's not standing very sturdy either. So it's top heavy and has some bad feet, meaning that this isn't the most stable thing that's ever been put together. But also what's interesting is the strength of the metal as you go down gets stronger. Gold is probably the softest of these metals, then silver, then bronze, and then iron, indicating that the rule that these people execute becomes more and more militaristic and determined and fierce. When it says in verse 35, then the iron, the clay, the bronze, and the gold were crushed all at the same time, indicating that this mountain didn't just smack the toes, then smack the thighs, or it hit the head first, or it landed on the head and smashed it all the way to the ground. It hit the toes, and when it hit the toes, when it hit the feet, the whole statue at once turned to chaff, indicating that there's coming a time when the rule of the Gentiles is over with, and it's instant. And there isn't anything left over. The fact that it becomes chaff, that's an interesting symbol there, because chaff signified judgment. It was a sign of the wicked. It was a sign of worthless material in the harvest. And this stone causes this enormous, extraordinarily splendor statue that was awesome and caused Nebuchadnezzar to fear to just disintegrate all at once. And then it says that the stone became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. And it seems to indicate that this happened very quickly. So here's a contrast. This stone is growing and filling the whole earth, and the statue is becoming chaff. Verse 36 says, this was the dream. Now we shall tell its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them. You are the head of gold. Now, several things are interesting in these two verses. One, obviously, Nebuchadnezzar's the head of gold. He's the beginning place. But in verse 37, there's an expression for Nebuchadnezzar that Daniel attributes to him. He says that Nebuchadnezzar is the king of kings. Now, that's an interesting statement to make about a Gentile ruler when I thought Jesus Christ was the King of Kings. Well, let's think about it a little bit here. It says, to whom the God of heaven has given. This was not Nebuchadnezzar's rule. This was God's rule. God has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. Now, we're going to find out, we know the story of where Nebuchadnezzar thought all of Babylon was his doing, but even from the very beginning, Daniel let Nebuchadnezzar know that it wasn't Nebuchadnezzar's doing. It was God's doing. God had given him these things. In verse 38, Daniel says, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them. If we turn back to Daniel chapter 2, verse 21... when Daniel praised God, he said in verse 21, and it is he, that's God, who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. Why is Nebuchadnezzar king? Because God put him there. He is the head of gold. And in some sense, there is some splendor about this individual Nebuchadnezzar, even though he was used to bring judgment upon Israel. Now, what I find to be interesting is the extent and the degree of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, as stated in verse 38. It says, wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beast of the field, or the birds of the sky. Now, that ought to make you think of something else in the Bible. A king ruling over beasts and birds. That's Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. This is the purpose for man's creation. Man was created to rule the earth and to rule the creatures on the earth. And in a little tutoring session I had this week, I tried to explain to some third and fourth grade kids, or fourth and fifth grade kids, that this is what it means for man to be created in the image of God. For if we think about man having intellect and personality and emotion and will, well, the angels have that. If we think about man having a spirit, well, the angels have that. What is the division that makes men different than angels? They were created to rule. But in Adam's sin, man lost his rulership. But here we see a Gentile king that it seems like this rulership is being given back to man so he can rule over the birds and the beasts and over all the earth. But what happens? The head of gold becomes silver, becomes bronze, becomes iron. It deteriorates because man cannot rule in sin. On the other hand, if we look on Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, it says, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man. Now here's a son of man. Now what are the sons of men supposed to do? They're supposed to rule the earth. What does this guy do? One like a son of man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom. So why did Christ come? Certainly Christ came to redeem us from our sins. But he came so that we might be put back in that place where we belonged as rulers over the earth. But as sinful creatures, we can't be there. So he has to redeem us, and then he puts us in a place of rulership over the earth. Well, that's where Nebuchadnezzar was. That is what man is supposed to do. Man is supposed to be a king on the earth, that God has given the kingdom and the power and the glory and the strength so that he rules over the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky. This would be the head of gold, the proper place of man. But it doesn't stay there. In verse 39, it says, and after you there will arise another kingdom inferior to you, then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. Now, when it says inferior, it doesn't mean smaller in size, because Medo-Persia was probably larger than Babylon, and Greece certainly was larger than both. So it doesn't mean inferior in size. But what happened? When Nebuchadnezzar said he wanted something done, it was done. But think about the Medes and the Persians. When the king wrote the law that said, whoever worships another god, he'll be thrown into the lion's den. And then he finds out that he was tricked so that Daniel would be thrown into the lion's den and killed. Why did he not, as king, say, well, that rule's bogus, I'm not going to do it? Because he was no longer a king like Nebuchadnezzar was. And this idea of this central authority where one man was ruling as king, the king of kings, began to deteriorate as well. And this idea of rulership is becoming corrupted as we go down the statue. But it does not become less in scope because it says the third kingdom will rule over all the earth. So it actually seems like they become stronger and more militaristic even as they become inferior in quality. Verse 40, then there will arise a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things, so like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. So Rome will come into play and destroy all the previous kingdoms. What's interesting is, even though Medo-Persia conquered Babylon, it took in some Babylonian ways. And when Alexander the Great conquered the whole world, he took in some ways of the world. And even though Rome crushed everybody it met, it still took in Greek influences. But when the stone that's cut without hands crushes, nothing's left. So these kingdoms all borrowed from one another, all from one another, even though, as it says here, Rome would crush them. Verse 41, "And in that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom. But it will have in it the toughness of iron, and as much as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. And as the toes and feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and some will be brittle." Many commentators say that the ten toes are ten kingdoms. And when you read elsewhere in Daniel and you read in Revelation, you read about the seven heads and the ten horns and the ten diadems, it sure seems like these ten toes represent ten kingdoms. But it wasn't completely agreed upon as to what is meant by "some of it will be strong and some of it will be brittle." The one thing that seemed to be in everybody's possibility, and most of the commentators threw out two or three possibilities, the thing that seemed to be in everybody's possibility was this merging of a dictator with democracy. Because, see, Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold, and no one told him what to do. The Medes and the Persians, the king could tell you what to do, but then you could tell the king what to do. By the time you get to Rome, you have this democracy and this Caesar at the same time, and it's sort of corrupted. Some people said it was corrupted because there were moral impurities in Rome, and that's what made it weak and corruptible, and that could possibly be the case. Or maybe they said it was possibly because Rome tried to gather in so many different influences that they couldn't keep the thing united. They couldn't keep the kingdom united because there were so many different influences that that's what made the kingdom weak. But in one way or another, this kingdom, though strong and militaristic, when it comes into this ten kingdom stage, some of it will be strong and some of it will be brittle. It says in verse 43, "And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery." And this is the reason why some of the people said that it was a political thing, because it says in the seed of men, instead of just one ruler, there will be many men who are mixing in with this iron and causing it to be weak. Then in verse 44, "And in the days of those kings," and there's the idea of the ten toes being the kings, because it's not, obviously not going to be in the days of Nebuchadnezzar or the days of the Medo-Persians or the days of the Greeks. So it seems like "in the days of those kings" is referring to the ten toes. "And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever." Now notice the characteristics, four characteristics of this kingdom. It will never be destroyed. Though the statue is destroyed, the stone that becomes a mountain will never be destroyed. Nothing will be able to destroy it. That kingdom will not be left for another people. Gold, silver, bronze, iron, the kingdoms were left for other peoples and were conquered. This kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms. It crushes them and they don't exist anymore, but it exists, as it says at the end, but it will itself endure forever. So this kingdom won't be left for another people. On the other hand, it will crush everything before it, indicating that there is a work of God that will destroy the time of the Gentile rulers over Israel, and that kingdom will endure forever. Inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron and the bronze, the clay and the silver and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true and its interpretation is trustworthy. Basically, Daniel saying, because I told you what the dream was, and I told you you saw a stone crushing a statue made of iron, bronze, silver, and gold, and it turned to chaff, you can know that I have interpreted this dream correctly. Now, there are some disagreements in verse 44 as to what this kingdom is. And the disagreements revolve around the nature of the kingdom, the nature of the destruction of the previous kingdoms, and the time element in bringing about those destructions. And let me just go over a few things in disagreement between two camps. There is a camp known as the amillennialists who do not believe that there will come to pass a millennial reign of Christ on the earth. Therefore, the kingdom cannot be Christ's reign on the earth in that way. So they say the kingdom is the church today. Now, why do they say that? Number one, what happened to the stone after it crushed the statue? It grew and filled the whole earth. They say, well, that's what the church is doing today. It began and now it's growing over the whole earth. So they have a support for that. The church started in the Roman Empire. It was when Rome was ruling the earth that the church started and brought and then grew. And it seems like the Roman Empire is in existence when the stone comes into existence. They also say that Rome fell into the hands of 10 kings. Now, this is not entirely substantiated. But even if it did fall into the hands of the 10 kings, it fell into the hands of the 10 kings after Christ. And it seems like the 10 kings are before the stone, not after the stone, but be that as it may. And then they say that the New Testament clearly teaches that Christ is the cornerstone. So he is the stone that crushes the rule of the Gentiles and sets up his kingdom on earth in the form of the church. That would be an amill position from these verses, and they may have other things that they would say as well. The premill position says that there will be a kingdom on the earth where Christ is actually on the earth ruling in a political way, and these are the reasons why they say so. It says that the stone became a mountain suddenly, that it didn't take years and years and years and years and years for the stone to become a mountain and fill the earth. It did it rather quickly. And so that wouldn't be talking about the church, the premillennialists say. They also say Christ did not destroy Rome. If Christ is the stone that crushed the statue and the statue was obliterated, then Christ destroyed Rome. But Rome was still in existence after Christ's death and resurrection. So they say Christ did not destroy Rome, and so it can't be the church at this time. They say when Christ comes, or when Christ came, Rome did not have 10 kings, and therefore it can't be at the time of Christ's first coming. This one was the one that I think is rather hitting hard to me. Though Christ is a cornerstone, I do not know that at this time we could call him a smiting stone. In Revelation chapter 19, it says a sword comes out of his mouth, and with that sword he smites the nations, and he rules them with a rod of iron. Christ has not done that yet. Christ did not crush a kingdom. He may have become the cornerstone for the church, but I do not see Christ smiting the nations. The premillennialist also earth will not be left for another people, but we have all kinds of kingdoms on the earth today. And then they say the church is not a kingdom of the political realm. Nebuchadnezzar, the head of gold, was a political kingdom on the earth. The silver chest and arms was the Medo-Persians. It was a political kingdom on the earth. The belly and thighs of bronze, representing Greece, was a political kingdom on the earth. The legs and feet and toes of iron and clay was Rome, a political kingdom on the earth. And so it seems to indicate that the stone that crushes it would be a political kingdom on the earth. But the question is, has this happened? Has this taken place? Well, most of the premillennialists would say that the ten toes, the ten kings, is a future revival of the Roman Empire. And there's coming a time where these ten kings will rule over the earth, and it even speaks of it in Revelation with the beast with seven heads and ten horns and ten diadems, and another horn comes up and takes the rule over three of those horns and all that kind of stuff. That this is something yet future, and then Christ returns, hits the toes, the revived Roman Empire, and shatters all earthly kingdoms forever and ever. And there will never, ever be another man-ruled kingdom on the earth, but Christ's kingdom will be the kingdom upon the earth at that time. Differing views, some say the church is the kingdom, some say the kingdom is yet future. Then in verse 46, then Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel and gave orders to present to him an offering and fragrant incense. This is a strange thing. The King of Kings, the head of gold, the King of all the earth, bows down to a captive. This is strange indeed. The king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." Nebuchadnezzar understood who Daniel's God was, at least to some degree. And yet we'll find in chapter 3 that that understanding completely left his mind almost immediately. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, the chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel made request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. Here are these four Jewish boys promoted to the highest office in Babylon. Daniel chapter 1 and chapter 2 speaks to me volumes of God's sovereignty over the entire history of mankind, head of gold, silver, then bronze, and then iron, that God is in control of everything, and that the kingdom was given to Nebuchadnezzar by God. But then in this apparently obscure individual by the name of Daniel, God is moving very sovereignly in this one little individual's life as well. Bringing him to Babylon, putting him in the king's court, having him refuse the king's food, putting him in danger of not getting any promotion at all, and then being elevated to the highest position in the land. So I see the sovereignty of God in a grand scale and in a very particular scale, that God is in control of all things. And basically, I would say the key verse even of the whole book is in Daniel chapter 2, verses 20 through 23, that wisdom and power belong to God. And he gives wisdom to whom he desires, and he gives power to whom he desires as well. And those are in those verses also. Well, let's take a look at Psalm 103. And let's say the first six verses. Psalm 103. Let's say this together. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Bless his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget none of his benefits, who pardons all your iniquities, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pit, who crowns you with loving kindness and compassion, who satisfies your years with good things, so that your youth is renewed like the eagle. The Lord performs righteous deeds and judgments for all who are oppressed. This is a time now for the men to continue sharing.
A number of weeks ago, we had our brother Hauk here, and as you recall, he had some poems by John Newton that he read. He read one of them, and I liked that one so much, I asked him if I could get a copy, and he had one more copy at home, so he gave me the copy that he had with him, but he said, I'll give it to you on one condition, if you share some of these with the rest of the book. I'd like to share one with you this morning that I thought was particularly good. I ask the Lord that I might grow. I ask the Lord that I might grow in faith and love and every grace, might more of his salvation know and seek more earnestly his face. It was he who taught me thus to pray, and he, I trust, has answered my prayer. But it has been in such a way as almost drove me to despair. I hoped that in some favorite hour at once he'd answer my request, and by his love's transforming power subdue my sins and give me rest. But instead, this, he made feel the hidden evils of my heart, and let the angry powers of hell assault my soul in every part. Yes, more with his own hand he seemed intent to aggravate my woe. Crossed all the fair designs I'd schemed, he blasted my hopes and laid me low. Lord, why is this? I trembling cried. Will you pursue this worm to death? This is the way, the Lord replied. I answer prayers for grace and strength. These inward trials I now employ from self and pride to set you free. And break your schemes for earthly joys till you shall seek your all in me.
Yesterday there was an article in the religious section of the paper written by a Baptist pastor here in town. You may have seen it, maybe you didn't. Let me read this little article to you. says medical science has now discovered a whole series of diseases unique to preachers. Though these diseases are seldom fatal, they can cause much misery to both the minister and the congregation he or she serves. Here is a list of some of the more prevalent ministers' maladies and the symptoms of each disease. There is statistosis, which measures the effectiveness of every event by how many people attend. It constantly counts heads and announces totals to the congregation, and sinks deep into depression when crowds thin and statistics drop. It's also known as numbermonia. And then there is arthritis. It gets sermon ideas from sermon books penned by other preachers and seldom has an original thought that thinks no one notices, and so forth and so on. I'll skip some of this. But then it says hardening of the categories. Tends to see everything as black or white and lumps people into categories like conservative, liberal, fundamentalist, and so forth, and is fond of labels and stereotypes. But then there's the simple syndrome, reduces everything to simple formulas, is fond of certain point-by-point sermons, each point beginning with the same letter, also called formulitis. And there's flea bites. Moves to a new field of service every 2 or 3 years. Here's God's call to a new work. Whenever all the old sermons have been preached and dissension occurs in the church or another church offers a higher salary. There's halitosis. Strikes an angelic posture of perfection before the church and refuses to act like an ordinary human being. There's also jargonitis. Uses catchwords frequently, is fond of phrases like share a testimony, get saved, Christian walk, profession of faith, believe the word, etc. Insomnia, congregation knows the order of worship and the sermon content before entering the church building. The preacher uses the same phrases and tone of voice Sunday after Sunday. It's often linked in near lethal form with jargonitis, also called predictability gnosis. And then there's pneumonia, loves anything new and innovative and scoffs at tradition and old ways, chases cultural trends and worships the cutting edge. And then there's the old-timer's disease. Loves anything tried and true, never thinks outside the box, believes any innovation is of the devil, and feels a strong need to guard God. Now, I don't know what you think about any of this. It's so much foolishness, and I think it's man's ideas. And I read it not because I think this is profound. I hope you don't think that I do. Even though I think it has some funny, dry sense of humor associated with it. But I really brought this to read because it did one thing for me. And that is that in reading that, I just recognize the need, as it were, for self-examination, for one thing, and how we don't want to get so to ourselves that we don't really see ourselves perhaps as other people might see us, and so forth and so on. And that's important within the distinctives of this church. And I'm not in any sense of the word wanting to violate the distinctives of this church, because I believe those are the distinctives that are found in the Bible. But on the other hand, too, I also just wanted to encourage you along these lines. And that is, as God puts it in your mind and heart, that that you have ideas for how we should do things, or how we should do things differently, again, within the distinctives of this church, I wish you would be quiet and passive and not afraid to say those things to one of the men and let them know this is all of our ministry, and we want to make this ministry the best that it can be within the confines of worshiping God with all of our heart, mind, soul, and strength, and so that we don't get any of these maladies that are here in any sense, or some other maladies that might be just characteristic of us alone. Let's be sure and just keep that in mind, please. Thank you.
Gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you for this day, for your truth through your word, that we would have a right understanding of you and your ways, the way of your lofty thoughts, and how your train is the one that fills the temple. To see and understand in the life of kings that the heart of the king is in the hand of our God. You know, Father, that you do things all well. And Lord, that we might not be those who suppress the truth, but we would further the cause of truth because of your residence and a right relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ. Be pleased to stimulate us this day for good works, not of our own merit and strength, but because of thy workmanship and thy spirit living within us, that we would go forth in a world of darkness and sin to carry good news and light that would bring honor and glory to thyself. Use today as a day of worship, O Lord, that would draw us closer to yourself. May we be rich in your teaching and faithful in your deliverance to those who are outside of Jesus Christ, which brings honor and glory to yourself. And we ask these things in Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen.
If you're allergic to anything, you can drink all the
time.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Yeah, and let's give.
I didn't know those big, yeah, man.
I know
with the zeal.